You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to welcome you to.
We're actually going to be teaching a whole new language on this podcast.
Yeah, it's called MMA for the Mind.
Yeah.
Otherwise, do you want to be a mixed mental artist? Would you rather be an academic who only sees one sliver of the sky, or do you want to see the whole sky? Let us bring you out of the well, out of the cave, so to speak, my own allegory, and show you the light.
Brian, how's that? The level of literary references, this is just working on so many levels at the same time. There was Play-Doh mixed in there.
I'm highly educated.
Well, you're already practicing mixed mental arts.
That's exactly what I'm doing. Guys, at the end of the day, we've all got a paradigm that we apply to reality, and in fact, doesn't that limit us? Do you guys want to have a macro perspective? Do you want to understand literally everything?
Wow.
Look no further. The Brian Callen Show with Hunter Motz, who came up with the idea, MMA for the Mind. God damn it, I have no original ideas!
But Brian, that's part of the point, is that none of us does, right?
None of us do. Yeah. God damn
that's
it.
That's right.
You don't even speak good English.
No, I don't, but that's why we need
to... You don't even speak English good.
But that's the point, Brian. That's why we need each other.
Yes.
The point is that individually, none of us is that smart, right? But if you pile idea upon idea, if we take everything that both of us brings to the table, then we might become one semi-decent
human
being.
Tell me that I'm super smart, I just say, listen, man, all I have done is stand on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah.
That's all I say. And I don't say giants, I say big people.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I feel like giants is discriminatory.
It's one of those words like dwarf or midget.
Yes.
Like, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
A little person.
Or a big person.
Or a big person.
Or a medium-sized
person.
I
will say that I want more big friends. And when I say that, I mean the old term for that would be giant. But you can't feed giants meat because they're prone to rage.
Is that true?
Never give them a cudgel.
But wait a minute, you believe that if people eat meat, they get raging?
Only giants.
Only giants.
Yeah.
It's a unique phenomenon.
And you have to keep a mouse around because they're terrified of mice.
I
know people think elephants are, but it's actually giants.
Oh.
Yeah, because if they get crazy, you just release the mouse.
Brian, after you promised people that they would learn everything and be really smart, now you're starting to do that already with this giant talk.
I'm teaching them how to corral a giant.
It's a very important lesson.
I'm teaching them how to keep a giant from raging.
Wow.
And smashing everything with his club, his cudgel.
So for today,
yeah,
in terms of actually continuing on this journey of learning everything, I thought we would continue the conversation that we were having as you made me a cappuccino.
Yeah, you're really good at, I always turn to you for, because so many of us have these feelings, right? They're based on, for me, we started out by talking about how some of these rappers, like The Game. The Game is a very good rapper. The Game's actually an artist. He's got a lot to say. His music is really, really good, at least the first album that I listened to. I'm not a rap guy, but I really enjoyed his first album. And I try to spend as much time listening to all different kinds of music so I get a perspective. You know, like little Wayne or all these. I'm a white dude, a 49-year-old white dude. I didn't grow up with loving rap, and I had a judgment on rap and black ghetto culture. When you listen to Tupac, Biggie Smalls, mm-hmm. The Game, Jay-Z, Nas, and all of these rappers who came from very difficult circumstances, and certainly circumstances I know nothing about. What you find, of course, what a surprise, is they're highly intelligent, they're mm-hmm. very poetic, they feel deeply, and they are artists. So it's a really neat perspective for me. But I saw The Game. He's been posting these pictures along with this other guy who's a model, and with his half-hard dick, which is very impressive, by the way,
in
underwear and holding it and then taking a selfie with it. And you're not my friend if you do that. It's kind of like the guy in the gym who's got a great body who takes his shirt off to work out. You're not my friend. You're just a vain moron. What I was reacting to is, yes, we all laugh at it, but it's kind of accepted.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like we live in a culture of narcissism. We live in a culture where it's fine to do that. Now, I'm sounding like an old guy because I don't think millennials are less less are more superficial than I am. I don't believe that. I know there's this idea that, you know, older generations always say, these millennials, they just don't understand. They don't understand the meaning of money or value.
Yeah. And
they're superficial. No, I don't think so. I think they are looking for meaning like any other human being. I think it's a mistake to judge my younger the younger people that make up my popular culture. But having said that, there are certain manifestations on social media that just make me cringe. It's a little bit like Jonathan Haidt, that disgust, this sort of thing. You don't know why it disgusts you. So even though a brother and sister have sex in the woods and they might use a condom and nobody is watching, is that hurting anybody? It may not be hurting anybody, but it elicits a sort of a cringe. Sort of the cringe mechanism,
right?
You know, cringe impulse where I go, oh, and it's the same thing when I see The Game or anybody else showing off,
right?
It's why I viscerally dislike Donald Trump,
right?
But and so, you are saying to me,
yeah. So this is the point, is that the point of what this MMA for the mind is to do is that we have all of these intuitions,
yeah,
right? We have all of these impulses. And the reason why most education is ineffective is because it stays at the level of our rationalizations, right?
Yeah.
And I just listened yesterday to Sam Harris and John Haidt. And
I just listened to Sam Harris on Joe Rogan.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
But what John Haidt was saying, the difference between him and Sam Harris is that John Haidt believes that, you know, people are mostly driven by intuition, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas Sam Harris has much more faith in the power of human reason. And the idea of reasoning our way through problems is a very old Enlightenment idea, but it's not borne out by any of the research, right? Daniel Kahneman, right, his whole thing is about thinking fast and thinking slow. Most of our thinking is fast. It's this intuitional thinking. And only occasionally do we do this slow thinking where we really reflect on our intuitions and dredge them up. And in terms of, you know, working with students, that's what really changes their lives. What changes their lives is not that we engage in a bunch of content and like, oh, we're going to talk about math or English or anything like that. It's about getting down to those intuitions. Do you really think you can learn, right? How do you think learning works? How do you think your memory works? And if you can change those intuitions and those fundamental beliefs, the stuff that's deep, deep down, that's when you really change the direction of people's lives pretty quickly, mm-hmm, right? So the irony is that if you want to change your life quickly, you have to go slowly. So that's what we're doing here, is that we're going to drag these things out. So
yeah,
you've got this intuition that there is something fundamentally wrong about this sort of very exhibitionist, superficial behavior, and that's not behavior that should be rewarded by a culture or society.
Yeah, by the way, I don't think that's lost on most people, right?
No.
Most people kind of feel that way.
Yeah.
But most of us, because there isn't much at stake, mm-hmm, it feels... Like, in other words, there's not an existential threat. The barbarians are not at the gate necessarily. They may be proverbial.
But they are. And this is the challenge, is that human...
Well, what I meant to say is that typically we just look at that as harmless,
but
and we go, it's fine.
But should we look at it as harmless? And
that's the question. That's
the key thing, is that you have to understand that there's a big difference. Like, our minds are very good at handling certain problems.
Yeah.
So it's very obvious. Like, the threat of something like terrorism is very obvious. There's a guy who's blowing people up, killing people, chopping off heads, all of that sort of stuff. No human being has to work hard to understand that as a danger.
Yes.
In practice, if you read someone like George Friedman talking about, you know, is terrorism an existential threat? It's not.
Right.
The reality is that Al-Qaeda or ISIS, you know, as it stands today, could never occupy Minneapolis.
Right.
They could never, like, they don't have the capacity to fly in enough troops, parachute.
This is not
in,
the Mongols.
The
this
city.
Is not the Mongols at the walls of Baghdad.
No, they can't.
Yeah.
The whole point of terrorism is that it's how a weak enemy damages a strong enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do is that they do things that are so emotional that create terror that what happens is that we overestimate the danger of them and then we expend a bunch of resources.
Yeah.
This is
maybe undercut our own freedoms, etc.
100%. And fundamentally this is something
and stand in line for a long time at TSA.
Which is
significant.
But it's all these things that start to weaken and damage the society, but it's a self-inflicted gunshot wound.
Right.
That's the real point. And you know, all of the Mujahideen, who are the guys in Afghanistan,
yep,
who came out of this, they understood this. They understood that the way that you make something like the Soviet Union fall is that you bankrupt it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what they're trying to do now. And the problem is that we buy into that thinking because we don't really understand terrorism, the majority of us. But Separately, there are existential threats that are much more vague, like campaign finance. Campaign finance is one of these things where it's not that any one of the actions seems so bad, right? It's very hard to pin down.
Yeah.
And
it's also hard to even understand.
Well, exactly.
Some things are insidious, right?
Right.
They're insidious. It's like you it's almost like somebody said you'd rather be a Coke addict than an alcoholic because Coke is so devastating quickly that 3 years later you look around, you have no resume, you got no family, no house,
right.
And you can get yourself together. Alcohol can take 30 years before you wake up and go, oh, no, and this has actually affected me. And I think it's a similar thing.
Eating disorders, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the point is a person can live without alcohol. A person can't live without food. So people who have eating disorders, they're constantly trying to, manage something and being like, how do I eat, in some sort of reasonable way, right? And rather than, going to some sort of extreme. So these sort of insidious threats that you're talking about, that's what the change in social media represents. It's insidious. And I posted on Twitter and I sent you this question, right? Who is more of a threat to Western civilization, Kim Jong-un or Kim Kardashian? Which Kim is the bigger threat?
I love it.
And the point is that, little Kim, right, the Korean Kim, I think is actually less of a threat to Western civilization than big-butted Kim, right? Kim Kardashian.
Yeah.
And that's because, fundamentally, someone like Kim Jong-un, you have to understand, what is Kim Jong-un's strategy? How does...
Terrorism, essentially.
He's terrorism, but what he has to do is he has to maintain the crazy Ivan, right? Mm-hmm. He has to be crazy enough that nobody wants to mess with him, but not so crazy that we're like, oh my God, we have to take him out.
Yeah.
If Kim Jong-un ever actually, say, nuked Seoul,
it would be game over
for him, because now the worst thing has happened, and so the world rallies around taking him out, right? But, so he can terrorize his own people, and he will terrorize his own people, and he can spread fear around the world, but there are limits to how much damage he can do, right?
Yeah.
He remains the hermit kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, someone like Kim Kardashian is fundamentally shifting the secret of Western society's success, which is our culture. And what she's doing is she's hijacking these systems of what is...
By the way, you're using Kim Kardashian in a metaphorical way.
Yeah, in a metaphorical
way. It's not her herself, but just
no.
the example of...
And I bear her no ill will, and I think the important thing is...
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
And to be clear...
But she's a manifestation of sort of what's available and a diversion of attention from the things that we should probably be thinking about and be inspired by.
And crucially, not only that, the things that are going to pay the average person's bills.
Yeah,
right?
That's right. That's
like
a good point.
This is talking about practical. If, for example, imagine that, and Kim Kardashian doesn't have to remain trapped in what she's doing. She's figured out how to grab people's attention. Mm-hmm. But let's imagine that Kim Kardashian uses her millions and millions of followers to inspire people, lots of little girls and whoever else, to learn programming, right? How to code. Right?
Yeah.
It would be incredible.
Yeah.
Right? She's going to be much more effective at reaching the people for whom that's really going to change their ability to make a living.
Well, you were talking about the difference in influence, which is there is dominance and there is prestige.
Right.
Right? So dominance is what caused the power to cause you to avert your eyes and to be subjugated to the alpha's will or your leader's will. That would be Kim Jong-un.
Well, Kim Jong-un uses both.
Yes.
Right?
He does use the cult of personality, but whereas there's prestige, which is that control mechanism, which can be very good in time, because what happens is human beings copy their superiors. Kids will look at, in a hunter-gatherer society, they'll look at those people that hunt well, that tie knots, that do those things. And they'll start by emulating, not the skill set because they haven't learned that yet, but they'll start by emulating sort of how they dress and how they talk.
They act. And
how
talk.
They act.
Yeah.
And then slowly they because they want to be like that, they start to learn, well, to be like that, you've got to do like that. And now begins the process of learning a skill.
Right.
And with that comes all the things that a responsible human being will develop: self-control,
right?
Humility,
all of those things.
Generosity, and the rest. But you were saying that advertising, which is essentially what Kim Kardashian is, and what a lot of social media is, advertising hijacks that mechanism.
100%.
where they take perfume or they take a hamburger and put it next to Michael Jordan's face or mm-hmm. LeBron James' face. They say, if you want to be like LeBron, drink Coke and eat this hamburger.
That's where it
starts and ends.
Right.
Whereas, of course, that's not going to bring you any closer to LeBron. In fact, it might take you farther away from LeBron.
100%.
And in that sense, advertising not just a lie. In that sense, social media and emulating Kim Kardashian because she's got a great ass and she sparkles is probably more harmful than it is good.
It's socially parasitic, right? I'm not saying, like, I think one of the things that has to be clarified as we talk about all these things, which is what you brought up,
yeah.
is the fundamental attribution error, right? So there's a tendency, like, one of those things that's in our psychology is the tendency to think that people do these things because they're this kind of person.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And
that's one
of the ground rules, and especially that's a problem in the West. So there's always the danger anytime you start having these sort of conversations, which are really sort of about, like, these insidious effects that, you know, we sort of are saying, oh, Kim Kardashian is sitting there in some vast conspiracy, knowing exactly what she's doing, right?
Right.
But, you know, I think sort of one of the ground rules for this MMA for the mind is that any time that, you know, you and I are talking about something, what we're really applying is what's called Hanlon's razor, right? So everybody sort of knows Occam's razor, which is that all things being equal, the simplest explanation is the truth. Hanlon's razor is that if in doubt, and don't attribute something to malice, attribute it to stupidity, right? So a lot of these conspiracies that rely on the idea that
there's a cabal of evil men.
And really, it's sort of cluelessness or myopia, right? Yeah. Or the sort of short-sightedness, because it's the reality is that we're all specialists, right? There are things that you and I do for a living, and we know those things. And then the instant that, you know, say I walk into a car dealership, I'm utterly clueless. I have no idea. So I may have totally screwed up my car, but it wasn't because of malice. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to deliberately screw up my car. It's just cluelessness. And
yeah.
So there's just, we're all inevitably in a society as complex as what we've got, we're going to be clueless about the effects of many of our actions. And that's why, I mean, we really need to have conversations like this so we can sort of all wake up to, oh, wow, I didn't even realize that that was the effect of my action.
Mm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not people like Kim Kardashian, what they're doing is that they're grabbing attention. They know how to do that. But
yeah.
attention is your most valuable resource. If you put your attention on getting good at boxing, then you will get good at boxing. If you put your attention on getting good at programming, then you will get good at programming. If you put your attention, whatever you put your attention on, that's ultimately what you become, mm-hmm. right? That's the basis. So your most valuable resource, they are dragging towards themselves for the purpose of getting you to buy stuff you don't need, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're then selling your attention on to advertisers.
Mm.
So you have to be aware that it's okay. Like, we all have this, you know, we all have these impulses. We have this impulse to be attracted to sex, to be attracted to shiny things, to be attracted to, you know, emotion.
What's popular.
Yeah, what's popular.
What has status and
all
reputation.
These sorts of things. But, you know, for the listeners, I think the practical value is to be aware that we have this tendency to blindly copy what prestigious people are doing or what people who grab our attention are doing, so that you can then say and reflect and say, do I really want to do that? Who do I want to give my attention to? Where do I want to put my attention?
Mm-hmm.
And
That to me is always what it comes down to,
mm-hmm.
you know, because we do have real problems and challenges. And those problems and challenges are going to be solved by the upcoming generations.
Yeah.
And I do think that it is a question of, there's only a limited amount of emotional and mental energy you have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, like anything else, too much eye sugar.
Yeah.
is going to take away from what you could really accomplish,
100%.
What you could really contribute to the mm-hmm. greater good. Because it really, in a lot of ways, comes down to that, doesn't it? Doesn't the people that revolutionized the human condition,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure were complicated people, some people were very, but at the end of the day, when you come up with a better way to do something, there are two things that go hand in hand with that. One is, there are people that come up with better ways to do something. However, getting that idea and that mechanism out to the greater good, i.e. our popular culture,
mm-hmm.
is a completely different thing.
Yeah.
It's a completely different thing, because what we're talking about now is getting that idea
out there.
Out there. And accepted and put into practice. And for whatever reason, and mainly if you listen to Jonathan Haidt, it's because we're emotional creatures, we have a hard time putting that into our mental arsenal.
Well,
our practical arsenal.
I think one of the important things in talking about cultures is that very often cultures set themselves up to sabotage their own goals. The way the culture is set up doesn't actually serve the goals that they want. So there are things that we want, right, as a society. We want our children to be educated. We want, you know, everybody to be as healthy as possible. We want, you know, fiscally responsible government. We want all of these things. But we have cultures and different competing cultures that have values and beliefs that don't serve those goals.
Yeah.
So, for example, there's often this notion among sort of Democrats that big government is good for the poor.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not. If you read someone like, you know, Hernando de Soto's The Other Path, or you read Luigi Zingales, who we had on the podcast, A Capitalism for the People, right? Big government, really complicated legal systems are good for people who can afford expensive lawyers, which is the rich.
Yeah.
So what you actually want, it's not that you want, and a lot of these arguments are rather silly because people talk about wanting big government or small government. What you want is you want elegant government. You want a government that is simple as possible, but no simpler. So that's really, I mean, you know, what elegance is something that emerges from switching between perspectives. And that's another one of the big themes.
Feels like it's a word that goes hand in hand with harmony.
Yeah. You know. And you have to understand that at all points you're dealing with a trade-off. Hmm. You're not going to get a perfect system, but you know, you have to understand that the bigger and more complicated you make something, there's a cost. And the smaller and more simple, there's a cost. There's a danger that things that are simple become simplistic, and there's a danger that things that become big and complicated become unusable, right? In a software context, they talk about featureitis, right? Great software doesn't have every single feature possible. It has the number of features that is maximally useful to you, and that depends on who you are. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, these things can become clunky, and that's essentially, I mean, that's where we are, right?
Yeah.
The government and the legal system are not very user-friendly, right? If it was a piece of software, nobody would download it, and everybody would give it one star.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Right. So, but the point is that the goal of, you know, creating a society which is as inclusive as possible for people who don't have a lot of financial resources is a great one. But that doesn't mean that our cultural beliefs and intuitions actually serve that goal.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And so that's what we have to do, is we have to dredge out those intuitions and then examine them and see, do these intuitions really make sense?
That's probably, you know, you're articulating my emotional response to things like the game showing his dick.
Yeah. But that's exactly the point of this. But so
Dan Bilzerian.
Yeah.
All those guys. That's kind of where maybe that's what goes on, where I think to myself, and maybe it's unfair to these individuals in particular, who cares? But you know, man, you have a million followers.
But that's the thing.
You could do a lot with it.
Well, exactly.
And I'm being, again, though, I understand somebody saying, come on, dude, he never signed up for that. That's not his. He's a business. He's trying to make money himself. He doesn't even understand that.
Of course.
But yeah.
But I mean, let's talk about dream scenarios, right? So yeah.
I guess that is what we're, maybe we're being too theoretical.
No, but I don't think so. I think the point is that Kim Kardashian has a problem. Let's talk about Kim Kardashian's problem. And her problem is she needs to turn the story. She needs to maintain interest and she needs to keep people interested.
Yeah, kind of like Madonna.
Madonna or Dan Bilzerian or all these sorts of things. And how long can they do variations on the theme of like, oh, I have guns, I'm surrounded by prostitutes, look at my big
prostitutes?
Plane. Well, that's Dan Bilzerian.
Girls that need help. They girls that need help with their rent.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Damn it.
I won't. Anyway,
some of them have real tits too. Keep going. Jesus.
But Dan Bilzerian or Kim Kardashian, they have to keep people interested.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you really want to keep people interested, like if Kim Kardashian really wants to turn the story, well, imagine if Kim Kardashian actually starts changing the world and improving young girls' lives or whatever it may be. I mean, what better rebuttal to the haters? years. Like, yeah. Well, you've been hating on me.
It's kind of like what Oprah did. Oprah.
Yeah.
Oprah realized she had this incredible audience and she created a book club. She 100%. Got people on there that were talking about things that actually mattered. You know, it really does come down a lot of times to those people that appeal to your appetite.
Mm-hmm.
And then those people that appeal to the bigger ideas.
But the point is that if you think about what Oprah achieved with that book club, right? Mm. That was good for Oprah. Because Oprah now not only has like financial success and followers and all of that sort of stuff, but she has social prestige. People feel like Oprah is a force for good in the world.
Yes.
There's no reason why Kim Kardashian can't redefine her brand or Dan Bilzerian can't redefine his brand to move in that direction. From a learning point...
That's almost not their responsibility, though. It's not. That's the thing. It comes down to we were talking about this, Gary Taub's book, who I want to get on the podcast, who wrote a book, Why We Get Fat and What to Do About It, which was a shortened version of Good Calories, Bad Calories, a book I also read, which is mm-hmm. a very big book. But it's a great book because, and I heard him talking probably 10 years ago on NPR about the idea that food should be treated like a drug in our entire paradigm. The idea that eat less and exercise more is how you lose weight is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that the idea that dietary cholesterol and fat causes you to be unhealthy is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
None of that has ever been used. None of that has been proved in human experimentation. In fact, probably not even in rats. And the people that were driving this debate were people like Ansel Keys and Jean Mar, who were charismatic guys who had an agenda mm-hmm. and stumbled upon this thing and extrapolated from there. Blah, blah, blah. The point is that we know if you talk to real exercise physiologists, strength coaches, in fact, even bodybuilders, CrossFitters, that there is a way to keep the fat off. There is a way to be optimally healthy. And a lot of times it has a great deal to do with saturated fat,
right?
Animal protein, vegetables, no sugar, no carbohydrates. Try getting that very simple philosophy just to your diabetes doctors.
Right.
My buddy has type 2 diabetes. When I told him how to change his diet, his doctors at Cedars-Sinai,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not exaggerating, but my buddy Jerry McFadden, at Cedars-Sinai, or it was Mount Sinai in New York, were like, we don't understand why your blood sugar levels are at 100 because he's not eating bread.
Yeah.
But it's amazing. Again, we always talk about how frustrating it is. It's amazing how slowly these ideas that can really be a force for good mm-hmm. and change. It's amazing how slowly those ideas
and part of
jump to the other side.
Well, but also part of it is that, you know, what I'm part of what I want to achieve here and I think we should aim to achieve here is that, you know, we all know that unchecked power is bad. Right? We want to check the power of the market, right, through competition between different companies. We want to check the power of government, right, through voting and all this sort of stuff. But the great unchecked source of power in our society is intellectual power, right? Doctors have a huge, huge amount of power, right? Scientists have a huge amount of power, and they should be responsive to the research. But there's a complacency and a sort of conventional wisdom that exists in these fields, and the citizens are supposed to hold them accountable. Does it make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Or, you know, teachers.
But the citizens have got to know the difference.
Well, exactly. And that's the crucial thing. You know, you go to your teachers. What people don't realize, I mean, especially in education, there are all these whacked out theories that float around education, and they don't drag them out. They don't explain them to you in a parent-teachers conferences, but they're how they run their classrooms, how they approach teaching. And, you know, most of the time, parents are sort of shopping at this very high level, right? You shop for a school, and you're like, oh, this school is nice. It has a swimming pool. It has all of this sort of stuff. But the real
question is, whatever.
But the real question is, what does the teacher believe about education? What do they believe about human potential? What do they believe about how you deal with mistakes? What do they believe about all of these things? What is their understanding of the individual human mind? And that never really happens. And that's the level that really, really matters. And so it's the same thing. You go to your doctor, right? How do you shop for your doctor? You shop for your doctor because, oh, they have a degree from this university, right? Some sort of piece of paper.
And somebody recognizes recommend them. That's always cracked me up when they say he's the best. He's the best doctor.
Yeah.
How do you know he's the best doctor? Where's the data on that? Well, you know what I mean? No, we went to the best. This guy's the best. Is he the best?
But it's
he's got a white beard and he's at a hospital. I get it, but you don't know that. But you don't have data for that.
But that's about those feelings. Everybody wants to believe they're going to the best. And like, if you look at the psychology of what happened around Bernie Madoff, right? All these people were highly defensive of Bernie Madoff. And anybody who came in and sort of said, I don't know, 10% returns every year, it seems a little fishy, right? They were like, you don't know, how dare you? Like, he's the best, right? But so, again, like, I think a large part of this is accepting how simple your brain is, right? You have these sort of impulses towards, he's the best. And we use that again and again, but once you become aware of that and you can spot that, then you don't buy into that. And that's the same thing that you're already doing in terms of the doctors. You're like, really? Is he the best? How do I know? So you're a little bit more skeptical, and then you go and you investigate and you make your own decision. Mm-hmm. And you all also have had these experience with, you know, this Gary Taub book. Is it Gary Taub?
Yeah, Gary Taubes.
But you're aware that you know, but through doing this, you understand that good ideas don't necessarily diffuse. Conventional wisdom has always been a problem, and it is still a problem in many fields.
Well, we were talking about, you gave me that study where sailors were dying of scurvy 200 years after the first controlled experiment proved that a little lime juice will keep you alive.
That's
You won't have spongy gums.
Your teeth won't fall out.
They won't fall out, and you won't fucking die. And it took 200 years for at least the British Maritime Society to adopt, you know, the conventional wisdom that if eating sauerkraut or limes or whatever it might be will keep you scurvy free.
And that's from the diffusion of innovation.
I talked to Rogan about this. I ran into Joe Rogan, my dear friend, at the airport. And Joe has got, I mean, he's getting 30 million downloads a month. He's a phenomenon.
Right.
And if you know Joe, it's not surprising. Because everything he does is, you know, there's only gear 10 with that guy. There's no like, let me do a podcast. No. Like everything about him, I'm going to do archery. I'm going to practice 12 hours a day until my back breaks. He's out of his mind.
Right.
But having said that, what I've noticed with him, and I've been listening to his podcast, is he's having people on his podcast like Christine Summers, Sam Harris, leaders of thought. And I said to him at the airport, I go, because I borrowed your term. I said, dude, you're the bridge. You are the popular bridge. Like it or not, he hates that stuff. He's like, dude, I don't like this. I got to get out of here. But I said, you, whether you know it or not, are this popular bridge between the big ideas and everybody else out there.
100%.
And that's a huge responsibility. I didn't mean to put it on him, but, you know, that's that. Without someone like that, who, by the way, is a comedian first, a lot of people don't realize he's a comic, a great one, but he's a comic. Isn't it interesting that that's, but he's also a comic who's fascinated and interested in ideas he doesn't know about. And hopefully this is what we can do.
Yeah.
That is the bridge you need.
100%.
You need an emotional bridge. People like Joe Rogan because they want to be like him. Smokes weed, hunts, punch you in the face. He's got a caveman quality to him, but he's also got this very complicated side as well. This inquisitive mind, this weird thing. So,
but it's also, I think, the other thing.
My larger point is that he's an example probably of a manifestation of popular culture that's doing something Oprah-esque.
100%.
Where I guess maybe my reaction to Kim Kardashian, Dan Bilzerian and stuff is that they don't have the brain power probably, and maybe it's not their job, but...
No, but they
could. It'd be interesting if everybody aspired to that as opposed to the other. Because for me, the end result with all of this stuff that I find so uninspiring is attention and money. I mean, and I want to sell you something, right? I've hijacked your attention. I'm Kim Kardashian. I'm Dan Bilzerian. I'm the game, whatever it is. I've hijacked your attention. And by the way, I want to sell you something.
And that's
I guess.
But the more
that you don't need.
But the more customers become aware of that, the more they can make better shopping decisions. And the point is, I think that, you know, you can look at that as a problem, right? But problems are opportunities. Right? When something isn't done well in a society, that opens up an opportunity for someone to come in and do it better. And that's essentially what Joe is doing, right? Mm-hmm. He's saying, I am going to both entertain you and provide you with interesting things to think about.
Yes.
Right? And the thing is that we can do better and better and better, right? Joe is getting better. We are getting better at doing that.
Yeah.
And essentially, what the real change is, you can, you know, complain about, you know, the post office, right? But rather than complaining about the post office, go set up UPS or FedEx,
yeah.
right? Or invent email or yeah. do whatever it is. Create some product that is better and that can outcompete it.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you build a better mousetrap, the world will beat a path to your door. And so I think that's the real thing, is that Kim Kardashian or any of those guys, they absolutely could change. I think that it is in their financial interest and in their social interest to become better at serving their customers, at providing things of real value to their customers.
Real value, yeah.
Right, which they don't. But if they did, I think they would be even more successful.
Maybe,
Maybe. But
it's a tough thing. You know, again, you were talking about something that I thought was a really interesting idea, which was that we live kind of in a duality here where we have meaningless entertainment
mm-hmm.
and we have boring education.
Yeah.
And so whenever you start talking about, like, if you really wanted to get into a conversation about politics, like a mm-hmm. real one, because I've had so many conversations with people that are successful, that are friends of mine. But if you really want to start debating the ideas and the questions, if you want to get into the root causes of problems, like campaign finance reform and stuff, well, man, it's a long conversation over dinner that's going to require some thought, patience, cultivation, yeah. Research. And nobody, you know, and I don't want to do that, for fuck's sake. I mean, you know, I mean, or I do, but I understand people going, dude, I'm just trying to relax, man.
Right.
I'm just trying to have a conversation and a laugh. I'm a silly goose. I'd rather laugh first over everything else. So I get it. You know, I get it.
But see, that's.
But I'm saying, yeah, that we have to figure out a way to make education less boring.
No, but I think that's the point. I mean, that's why, you know, I'm excited to do this with you,
yeah.
right? Rather than doing a podcast with Larry Lessig.
Yeah.
It's because that's your superpower, right? You, again, like Joe Rogan, you are a bridge. You feel perfectly comfortable in the world.
I'm also taller than Joe. It doesn't matter, but
I mean, you know, I wasn't going to say
wide,
that.
Not as wide, but I'm taller.
Yeah. But you know, you have that ability to blend those two things together. You feel comfortable in the world of ideas, but you also feel comfortable in the world of comedy. And so when you create things that are both, then you have something that's really compelling and really interesting and can really move those ideas.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, whoever it is that ends up doing it, whether it's Joe or you or Adam Carolla or some person we've never even heard of, the more people that are doing this and moving these ideas and doing it in a way fundamentally, I think, that is practical for people's lives. And that's what people don't realize, is that ideas are tools. Just as much as your iPhone is a tool, so is an idea. And you can practically use it to make your life better. We've already talked about a few mental tools that you can use here, like being aware that I blindly copy things. Right, being aware that my, you know, attention is my most valuable resource, and I should be really cognizant of where it is being pulled to.
Mm.
Right, these are tools that you use to make better decisions throughout the day,
mm-hmm.
and that's what MMA for the Mind is really about: is teaching people better mental tools.
Yeah,
those two tools that I just mentioned, along with a whole bunch of others, are just as fundamental to having a good mental game as, you know, a punch is fundamental to MMA or a kick is fundamental to MMA or whatever it may be.
Well, I really liked Joseph Hendricks' book, The Secret of Our Success, because it kind of gave me a way to talk about race mm-hmm. and a way to talk about how you separate human beings. So the way right now we speak about the differences in human beings is things like black,
mm-hmm.
white, Asian,
mm-hmm.
And those are actually meaningless categories,
right?
Scientifically, and they tell you almost nothing besides appearance, almost nothing about the differences, or rather the similarities,
right?
Which is probably more important, between human beings.
Well, they tell you,
you know, if you were to say to me, well, white people are actually just black people who need less sun to produce essential vitamin D.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you were to do that, which is really kind of the idea, as we move to higher latitudes,
mm-hmm.
we ended up having to lose the melanin in our skin
mm-hmm.
because we needed vitamin D.
Yeah,
that's one example. I mean,
right?
But there are, by the way, I may have way more in common with a Japanese, indigenous Japanese forager or a Tanzanian forager based on the enzymes in my saliva.
Mm-hmm.
Then the tribe right next to them.
But then the big sort of question, I think that for me always the big takeaway or the big thing to think about, right, is there's hardware, right, and that's your genes.
Yeah.
And then there's software, and that's your culture.
Mm.
And fundamentally, none of us at this stage with our level of technology can really do anything about your hardware, right? You can work within your hardware.
Epigenetics, you can jumpstart dormant genes.
That's right. And there are things that you can do in terms
overall, I'm not going to become a black man.
Well, Brian, I think, you know,
I mean,
there might be, you know, I mean, if you practice The Secret and you really sort of, you know, do a vision board of yourself as a black man, maybe
it'll
happen.
Which is exactly what I'm doing.
This is what it really comes down to. The issue is that the game has a bigger...
That's always what it comes down to. That's always what it's going to be. The first thing I would ask ex-girlfriends, is his dick bigger than mine? Smaller? Oh, cool. She's lying to me, but I'm fine. I can now sleep.
But that's a good girlfriend, one who lies to you about these things.
That's
right?
The only kind of woman I date.
Exactly.
Including my wife.
But the real opportunity, and the opportunity that we sort of haven't paid enough attention to, is what happens when we update our culture. And, you know, the reason why race matters is because people believe race matters, right? And it's by changing those beliefs, regardless of what your skin color has to be, that you can start to get better and better opportunities. Because, you know, you can overcome those ideas.
Yeah.
But so...
Well, yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I was trying to get at. I think the more you learn about evolutionary biology...
Mm-hmm.
And I think Henrik is an evolutionary biologist, isn't he?
Yeah. You know, he draws together... I mean, to write a book like his, you have to draw together research from a lot of fields, like anthropology and all these sorts of other things.
But that's a good example of the more you know about
100%.
How the science... the more you know about... how our machine operates and how it came to be.
That's right.
In a way, it's interesting because it'll make you more egalitarian.
Oh, 100%.
It'll make you less prejudiced.
Yeah.
It'll make you more fair. There's one thing I noticed about people that are not informed, that don't take the time to really understand why, for example, in my opinion, someone like Trump is a demagogue.
Mm-hmm.
And what a demagogue means, and why a demagogue is not so good for the trajectory of our culture and where we're headed, where we want to head. What happens is when you are relying on your fast thinking, on your emotional response, on your triggers, you are going to latch on very quickly to something that feels good immediately.
I think that, you know, my brethren, right, who went to Harvard, they don't do a lot of slow thinking. They mostly do fast thinking. It's a different kind of fast thinking.
Yeah.
But there isn't a lot
of
reflection.
In other words, highly educated people are not necessarily immune from fast thinking.
I think if anything, that's the point, and this is sort of Haidt's big objection, is that, you know, what has happened in what he calls the academy, but essentially elite universities, is that it has become so left-leaning that everybody is surrounded in an echo chamber of people who think like them.
Mm.
And so it just becomes this, you know, they're going down this rabbit
hole.
Yeah, exactly. And they don't fundamentally ever really have to think. And, you know, the fact that they spent, you know, $40,000 or whatever a year on that education, in inverted commas, doesn't necessarily mean that it's good, right? And the fact that there's a long history and sort of prestige associated with that brand doesn't mean that the thinking is good.
Mm.
So
what it does, the fast thinking in that sense makes you, whether you're from Harvard or you're, you know, you're somebody else, somebody I have in mind, is you are ultimately not a very fair, you're not being fair.
You're not wise, is really what it comes down to. And I think that's one of the big distinctions, is that there are, knowing, you know, throughout history, there have been people who have known lots of facts, right? There are endless numbers of high priests in every period of time who know huge numbers of facts about their Holy Scripture.
Look at the Nazis. 100%. Highly educated people.
Or, you know, if you go back to, you know, the Catholic Church during the Reformation, those guys know so many facts about the Bible. They can quote the whole thing chapter and verse.
Including Greek philosophy.
Right. But that doesn't mean that they're wise. Mm. Because wisdom is fundamentally... So when I talked about elegance, that's a good example of wisdom. Wisdom is what emerges from switching switching perspectives, when you switch between perspectives, because that's actually how the human mind works, you come to solutions that are better, right, than what happens if you just sort of narrowly look at things one way. If you narrowly look at government and think it should be big, right, then you constantly dial down on that sort of solution and you veer further and further away from a good solution. If you constantly think that government should be small, then you dial down on that solution, you go that way. And so, but, you know, real wisdom is saying you're going back and forth and you're saying, okay, you know, what is the best solution? Does this work? What are the negative consequences? And the sort of people that...
You're being scientific.
You're being scientific. And actually, like that quote that I sent you yesterday from Atul Gawande, right? Mm-hmm. The scientific mind is an experimental one, not a litigious one. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't get involved in legal arguments about, you know, doctrine and detail and all this sort of stuff. It's playing around. It's playing around with different perspectives and trying to find solutions that work.
By applying data and by applying measurable experimentation, right?
And by questioning your assumptions, which is
always starting with doubt.
Always starting with doubt and skepticism and wondering and seeing what the effects of your choices are. And that's what height is. That's why height is so, it finds it so objectionable that the academy has become so left-leaning. Because fundamentally, their assumptions are never questioned. Human beings will always have blind spots. That is one of the effects of culture. And that's why you need people around you who think differently so that they can point your blind spots out, right? This idea is an old one. It's in the Bible, right? Jesus talks about, you know, you hypocrite. You see the splinter in your brother's eye, but you do not see the log in your own eye.
Mm.
And so that's why you need people around you who think fundamentally differently so they can constantly be pointing out the log in your eye. And then over time, if you keep picking out that log, your thinking gets better and better and better, and you start to become wiser.
Yeah.
And if you're surrounded by people who think exactly like you think, right, it's a much more reassuring and comfortable feeling, mm-hmm. but you don't get wiser.
That's something that we all deal with. I was so influenced by my father
mm-hmm.
because I love him and I admire him and he's a very fair, smart guy, but he has an orthodoxy to his thinking. I adopted it hook, line, and sinker because it made so much sense and because I felt he was right. You know, I remember thinking if my dad was the president of the world would be awesome.
And it might be more awesome than it is right now.
I like the way he thinks because he basically believes in maximum personal freedom. And he'd probably, if he were the emperor of the world, he'd probably get away. He'd have a strong police force and strong courts and just literally not rule anything and just step off. Fine. But the point is that one of the harder things to do, especially as you get older,
mm-hmm.
is... doing exactly is switching your perspectives is continuing to question your assumptions, because it's really easy, even with these conversations and the conversations that we have with all these smart people, it's really easy to start to kind of gel
and settle into a new orthodoxy,
another word for a new religion.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking, you were saying that atheists are just as religious in many ways as scientists are just as religious as, you know.
Well, they have a vision of salvation, and their vision of salvation is if only we could get rid of religion, then the world would be better, right? And, you know, I mean, I've talked about this before on the podcast, and I get certain tweets from people who feel that I'm not being fair, right? And essentially, you know, what I'm doing is, in terms of those deep intuitions and what Haidt talks about in terms of, you know, moral foundations, is I'm violating, you know, certain norms around loyalty and authority, right? By their standards, I don't have any authority because I don't have a PhD.
To talk about
evolutionary science, to talk about any of these things, right? I only have a bachelor's degree from Harvard, which to some people is not very impressive, right? There are people who really respect academia and think you have to have a PhD or a professorship to be able to talk about these things. There's also norms about loyalty where they really believe that, you know, these people are doing a good thing for the world. And when you then challenge those foundations, then it sounds like you're being arrogant. As opposed to, you know, that you're speaking as clearly as possible, having tested your ideas as much as you can.
Mm-hmm.
And for you, people like you and
I... To be fair, you've read everything.
Not everything.
Well, no, to be fair, you're the most well-read person I've ever met.
And not only that, you've
had long conversations with a lot of those authors.
Right.
And, you know, I've been lucky enough to be privy to that. But so I mean, yeah, you have your bachelor's degree, but you're... Well, but pretty fucking educated.
But that's the big difference, I think, you know, between science as a startup and science as a mature institution. If you look back to 1776, you know, sort of the early days before they even had the word science, right? Back, you know, in the time of Newton or Ben Franklin, they talked about natural philosophy. They didn't even have the word science. The word science doesn't even appear until the 1800s, right?
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. So scientist is, I think, for the first time used in, I think, 1865 or something like that. It's sometime in that sort of period.
Wow.
Right? So these ideas didn't even exist, and you have someone like Ben Franklin, who Ben Franklin has no degree, right? You know, he was an apprentice in a printing shop and just sort of was interested in these things and just sort of casually read around and tried different things out. And, you know, he was involved in, like, defining the Gulf Stream. You know, he did experiments with lightning. He did experiments with electricity. He invented the flipper, right? Like for swimming, right? Stoves. You know, he was a tinkerer. He played around. He was an amateur. And so what that means is that his knowledge ends up being very broad because he's constantly exploring around in different fields.
Yeah.
That's a big, big difference from what happens when you have a mature institution like science today, right?
Right.
It's the same thing as what happens for the startup to a company. When you start to get further on, you get complacency. People get feared about losing what they have. Everybody gets divided up into departments, and the departments don't really talk, and they don't really see eye to eye. Nobody has a real overview of what the sort of big vision of the company is. And that's the problem that we've run into in terms of doing this podcast, is that we talk to these scientists and we often find that we as generalists, total amateurs just reading books, often have more familiarity with what's going on in the adjacent field, right, or in another field than the experts
well,
do.
Well, one of the most stark examples of that was David Sloan Wilson, who is a brilliant man. 100%. David Sloan Wilson is the guy that all the other academics we've had on the podcast mention. Mm-hmm. They talk about his work. He wrote Altruism
Exists.
What is it?
Altruism Exists.
Yeah, that's a great book. Altruism. Mm-hmm. Exists. He's an evolutionary biologist,
mm-hmm.
and he is a seminal thinker.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were talking about EvoCon,
mm-hmm.
A convention on evolution, and there was a little idea that maybe I would host it or something. I think Rogan would be better for that. Essentially, he said, I said, well, if you're looking for sponsors, you get an agent. You get an agent who would find you corporate sponsors for something like that. And David Sloan Wilson, this erudite scholar, said, Brian, this is fascinating. Are you suggesting that there are people that one can go to raise money, to actually that have contacts with these corporations? Hey, David, it's called an agent. Dude, how cloistered are you?
Yeah.
Again, this is a guy who spends all his brain power on that, you know, on other things.
But even within science. So I had, along those lines, right, in that email chain, I had a conversation with David Sloan Wilson, and he said, at some point, we should figure out how to get ideas to move. Right? This is something we should really study and figure out. And he'd written this whole long paper about how we might start to begin to tackle this problem. And I said, what about, and the scurvy story comes from this book from 1962 called The Diffusion of Innovations. And it's hundreds of pages long. And it's a huge study of how ideas move. And I said, what about The Diffusion of Innovations? Hasn't this problem already been studied? And he's like, oh, I've heard of that book, but I've never read it.
Yeah.
And so even you know, what you find is as you're talking to these academics, they very often like haven't even heard of these ideas. And the reason why these books are written, like The Better Angels of Our Nature and The Diffusion of Innovations, is to make these ideas accessible,
yeah.
right? It's at some sort of high level, but the basic concepts aren't very hard. We're talking about
them. It's here. Also, by the way, what I've also noticed talking to academics is that the tyrannical nature of academia. I mean, the tyrannical nature.
Yeah.
And it is a tyranny. Don't kid yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Every academic I talk to is so afraid to step out of his area of expertise
100%.
Because the backlash can be career-ending.
100%.
I mean, it's vicious. So, you know, I'm only an expert in this field. And, you and I know, I've learned that there's a language to education, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a language. There are the seminal thinkers. There are the big movements, the big ideas, and the big movements. When you get that, everybody speaks that similar language. And then you kind of branch off into your area of expertise.
Right.
Probably a little bit like medicine, right? It's fascinating to me to see how even in academia, ideas are stonewalled.
Yeah, they're not moving.
Yeah.
And there are people who are, they talk about, like a lot of what you hear when you go into academia is they talk about interdisciplinary work, right? But part of the interesting thing in terms of doing the straight A conspiracy is that we were just trying to get our students to try. That's all we wanted to do. And yeah. So what we did is that we went around and we read all these books, right? And then we just took whatever seemed useful to a kid. And we put it all together in one book. And yeah. We ended up putting together 7 different fields of research. Now, when we had Carol Dweck on, right? Yeah. What does Carol Dweck talk about? Carol Dweck talks about
mindset. Her
field. Yeah. And then she adds in neuroplasticity because that's an idea that doesn't really belong to anybody. And that's a large part of what this comes down to. It comes down to territory and belonging, right? Mm. And qualification and feeling like you can talk about these things. But so she puts together 2, right? And that's it. And that's because, I mean, we have an advantage over Carol Dweck because we don't have to worry about tenure. We don't have to worry about, you know, politics. We don't have to worry about people, you know, getting into the minutiae and, like, trying to tear us down. We're just trying to deliver something practical for a general audience. Mm-hmm. And in doing this podcast, I mean, that's the real goal, is that we don't have to deal with any of those things that academics have to deal with.
Viva the internet.
Yeah, exactly.
Viva podcasts.
We can just slap all these ideas
free speech
together. Yeah.
Freedom. Freedom.
and if you know, and if some academic comes on and tries to attack us and says you're oversimplifying things, we get to say yes, we are simplifying things, right? But the question is not are we creating something that is elegant? And that is really the key, is the level of complexity that is useful to a general audience. So if you look at, for example, how does the public think about, you know, germ theory, right? We believe in germs, right? And there are these little invisible creatures that I've never seen, and if I perform a magic hand-washing ritual, then they go away, right? It's a very simple belief, but it delivers, you know, most of the benefit. I don't get much extra by understanding that, you know, there are gram-positive bacteria and there are gram-negative bacteria, and there are these different types of protists. Like, that extra level of knowledge doesn't serve the choices, the practical choices that I make in life.
That's interesting.
Right. So if you want, you could go online and, you know, you could go into someone like Joe Henrich's book and you can go into the sources and you'll find a whole bunch of papers on prestige and dominance. And if you want, you could then go read the papers that those papers are based on. And you could spend thousands and thousands and thousands of hours digging down into that research.
Yeah.
But I don't know that you get anything more elegant than just understanding that there is prestige and there's dominance and that these two things are different.
Mm.
And so that's really the point of this MMA for the Mind, is that it is designed to be elegant. Mm. And in fact, I mean, I don't know a whole lot about actual MMA, fighting MMA, but I suspect that what happens is that as you merge different styles, there's an elegance that emerges from that.
You learn how to fight.
Yeah.
In other words, you know how to react to somebody trying to end you, because he might be a really good boxer, in which case you take him down.
Mm-hmm.
He might be a really good kicker, in which case you step in and get, you know, you wrestle him or you box him.
Mm-hmm.
There are 1,000 things that you know, essentially you learn how to fight.
Yeah.
So boxing is the skill of hitting somebody with your hands above the waist, whereas kickboxing is doing the same thing with your legs and your hands, where you're trying to kick or punch them to the ground or unconscious. Grappling is where there's no kicking or punching, but you learn how to put somebody on their back, get on top of them, and hold them down for 3 seconds. Or submission fighting is learning how to submit somebody, chokes, arm locks, etc., so that they have to tap out. And again, if a grappler tries to stand and punch a boxer, he's going to sleep. But then you put it all together.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's the crucial thing.
And now you learn how to fight. You don't learn how to box or wrestle. You learn how to fight.
And nowadays, as MMA is taught or passed on to the next generation of fighters, they don't make them go and, like, okay, first you're going to have to learn Taekwondo and Jiu-Jitsu and kickboxing. Mm. And you have to learn all these separate disciplines separately.
Yeah.
And then you can begin to put them together.
Right.
Right? What's happened is that it becomes more efficient. And that's what we're doing here. Yeah, is that
you learn MMA.
You learn MMA. And that's what we're going to do here is that rather than you having to go off and learn economics and anthropology and all these different things, we're going to give you MMA, right?
And why is that? So we can make sense of the world?
So I think there are, in terms of, like, the customer, right, there are 2 practical benefits, right? So the first thing to understand is that culture right, is the toolkit that you use to survive in a particular environment. Mm-hmm. So, the you know, for example, there's a great thing in The Lost City of Z, which is about like going to find this lost city in the Amazon. And the Lieutenant Colonel Percy Fawcett wanders in and he meets these locals, the Guarayo. And the Guarayo, what they do is they have these leaves that they take off of trees and they crush them on a rock. And then this fluid runs into the river and it creates a milky suspension. And then they wait a little. And then all these fish suddenly float up to the surface and turn over, right? And the little boy goes in and he just goes in and he picks the fish out of the water. That's all he has to do. He just has to pick them out.
Yeah.
And he only picks out the fattest ones and leaves the skinny ones in. And then he waits. And then the cloud dissipates. And then the fish swim away. They've literally stunned the fish with this leaf, and that's all they have
to
do.
So cool.
So cool. But that's culture and environment. That culture is useful in that environment.
It's not useful in the Arctic.
It's entirely useless in the Arctic. Yeah. And the reason why all these European explorers died is because they had this great culture that allowed them to know how to go down to the store and buy cans of tinned beef or whatever it is.
Play the violin.
Play the violin.
Build incredible cathedrals.
All that sort of stuff, and that's great culture. But the instant that you're in the Amazon, it's totally useless.
Yeah.
And so these guys die. So what has happened is that we don't have to physically move for our environment to change around us. Technology now changes that. Mm-hmm. So what's happened is that the educational system, for example, is still based on the idea of the industrial age. The reason why Trump has become so popular is because there are people who have a culture that is suited to a different environment than the one we live in.
Mm.
And so they don't know how to survive in that environment. And so the solution really is to, you know, give them the...
Well, they're looking for a blunt instrument.
Yeah, and fundamentally, they're blaming the wrong people. Yeah. Like, if the people that the Trump supporters should be blaming is not Mexicans, they should be blaming people like me. They should be blaming people who went to Harvard, who have created all this technological disruption without then providing people with the skills and the training and all of that sort of stuff to be able to succeed.
Yeah.
You know, we have simultaneously changed the environment, and then we have driven our own liberal agenda in terms of how education is done.
Hmm.
So we refuse to talk about beliefs, values, and all of that sort of stuff. So the real enemy here is me. And so this is my attempt in part to try and make
so
that
you're
right.
The real threat to Western civilization, not Kim Jong-il. Not not Kim Kardashian.
And that's
Hunter fucking Motz.
And that's why I tried to distract you with blaming Kim Kardashian. God, because it's really me.
You're an evil
yeah, it's true.
Son of
Hanlon's
a bitch.
Hanlon's razor doesn't apply to me. I am truly evil and malicious.
Jesus.
It's amazing, right?
Amazing. You're a big Dutchman.
But so the first thing is, yeah, how do you create wealth in a knowledge economy? And the crucial thing is that with the industrial age, it was about teaching people skills, right? So I teach you how to read, write, arithmetic, right? And there's a great quote from Alvin Toffler that the illiterate of the 21st century are the people who don't know how to learn, unlearn, and relearn. The most important thing is that we know that going forward, that we can't teach you the skills that you will use for the rest of your life. The world will change so quickly that you will constantly need to be learning, relearning, and reteaching yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So that you can update your culture based on the needs of the environment that you find yourself in.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first practical thing.
It's kind of how MMA is. The reason I love the UFC is because the sport is evolving so quickly.
100%.
That if you're not constantly updating your arsenal and constantly like learning, you're not going to be a champion. You're
that's
not
right.
going to be in the top five. You're not going to be in the top 10.
That's right. And yeah. and in terms
and,
of...
And probably... Our entire culture is that way, and so 100%. Is the job market.
100%. But we don't have the foundation for that, which is cultural rewiring, right? Constantly.
Well,
updating.
What we do is we'll go to someone like Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump and say,
right.
These guys want to build walls, or they want to take away from the powerful. And again, we're talking about the problem in the wrong way. We're blaming Bernie Sanders blankets the corporations and the banks, and Donald Trump, you know, blames the Mexicans, etc. Let's build a wall and China. Mexicans and China, they're the problem. We'll build a wall, both figuratively with tariffs and physically. He'll make it even 10 feet higher. That's where it's literally just you're putting all your attention over here.
Yeah.
And when it should be over here. It's exactly like saying Kim Kardashian's my hero.
100%.
Instead of someone like, I don't know, Hunter Motz.
No, Brian.
Go on.
But also Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush, right? They just want to do business as usual. And business as usual, doing more of the same, thing,
yeah.
right, is a different form of disaster,
yeah.
right? It'll be good for the people who are already in power and already have wealth, but it's not going to be good for the majority of us. And the basic problem of human society is always angry, lost young men, right? when young men don't know how to make a good living, right, and get a wife that they can feel good about and all that sort of stuff.
They buy a gun and march.
Exactly. It causes all sorts of problems. And that's the sort of the fundamental issue that, you know, the Middle East is having.
Isn't that what Islamic fundamentalism is
really
about?
It's all based on, is, you know, and the
because they want to feel significant, so they latch
on significant, to, yeah. and they want their society think they're cool, and they want to be able to get laid. A lot of this comes down to getting laid, and yeah. you know, having children, and having a home, and having a family, and being able to provide
dignity,
100%, and that's what they're not able to get. And you know, again, ISIS is something that we should be aiming to outcompete. Right, we can provide a much, much better strategy for kids to be able to do that than, you know, ISIS provides. Right, it's the same thing as like, why do African Americans go into drug dealing? Right, in the ghetto. Right, it's not a good life. Like, that's clear from anybody who's read Freakonomics. Right, the pay is shit. You get shot at. You have a high risk of death. You know, you're constantly being pursued by their society.
But you get some status and prestige.
Exactly. And like, you know, when we had Freeway Rick Ross on, it's not that Freeway Rick Ross isn't smart. It's not that he couldn't have succeeded in a whole bunch of other things. That was the opportunity that was available to him. Mm. And so the real thing is that, you know, you can hunt and shoot and do all this stuff to the drug dealers or the terrorists or whatever, but really, if you provide them a better pathway to success, then they'll take that pathway.
Yeah.
That's really what we're going to give, is the first and most fundamental thing is we're going to give you that MMA so that the world is constantly changing and that you can be in the top five, mm-hmm. right? That you can really be competing with the best of them. And in fact, you have to understand that just as we have an advantage in not being incumbents, right, not being part of the established big corporation where we can just go around science or whatever else and take the useful ideas and you put them together, the same thing is true for somebody who didn't go to Harvard. Right, you don't have to like defend your degree. You could give two shits, right? And you just can focus on what's practical. And so that gives you that same leanness that startups have, where you can move faster, you can fail faster, you can break, and you can improve things really, really quickly. So that's the first thing. I think the second thing is that, you know, humans hunger for meaning. We want the world to make sense. And right now, the world doesn't make a lot of sense to people. It's confusing. Why do people do the things that they do? It's often scary. And, you know, Facebook, I mean, you know, it's like there's just so much chaos going on. And part of this is the effect of technology, again, because what happens is that we invent technology and then our culture has to play catch up. Mm. So it's, we, the example that you and I have talked about is dueling. For ages and ages, men dueled, right, over their honor and all of that sort of stuff. And they generally dueled to first blood and mm-hmm. then they would stop. But first blood with a sword and first blood with a gun are two totally different things.
Yeah.
And so as, you know, you had the same sort of thing that we're seeing going on now is you have these big events like the Burr-Hamilton duel, where suddenly, you know, the sitting vice president of the United States and the former secretary of the Treasury engage in gunplay and the former secretary of the Treasury dies. Hamilton dies. And there's all of a sudden people are like, this must be changed. No more dueling.
Yeah.
And then it drags on for a few more decades, but eventually the practice dies out.
Yeah.
What we're having now with Facebook is that you have the Facebook. What we're dealing with now is that you suddenly have this communication, you know, weapon of mass destruction, right? Suddenly everybody can share their thoughts, right? Everybody is able to communicate with total strangers who we don't see face to face. And we're all trying to figure out, how do you handle this thing? And so the culture is going to have to catch up. And you're going to have to start having things like what Sally Cohn talks about with emotional correctness. And you're going to have to find better and better ways to be able to communicate with people whose faces you don't see. Because the face is how, like, as we're doing this conversation, this is not that hard, because we can watch and be like, am I losing Brian's attention? Do I have Brian's attention? Right? Mm-hmm. You know, are we taking turns speaking? All of those sorts of things. Whereas on Facebook, you don't have any of that information.
Yeah.
So
that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Talking to people who don't have a face.
Yeah. Well, and one of the more interesting things is that they found, for example, that, so this is why, you know, why do we have Ekman on the podcast? Because Ekman was really the guy who figured out that the face is the organ of human connection.
Yeah.
Right? So much of our communication happens because of these micro expressions that are flashed back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And what the amazing thing is that plastic surgery screws that up. because you can no longer...
Botox.
Yeah, it really does. And they found, and what it does, it creates an experience of loneliness because you're not getting that emotional feedback.
Wow.
Back and forth. And so, you know, you essentially, you've cut down the bandwidth. So I can no longer receive emotional information from you and I can no longer give it effectively.
Jesus Christ.
Right? And
I was about to go get some Botox, but I don't want to make anybody lonely.
Well,
or myself lonely.
Yeah. I mean, that's, and I think that's the real thing is, you know, people talk about like,
I'm never getting Botox. I'm kidding. Keep going.
But I mean, a lot of these things, right? Like people are upset about plastic surgery. And if you want to talk about plastic surgery, well, you can talk about it being bad or you should get comfortable with aging. It's like, no, it's really simple. You have a trade-off between, you know, do you look
good or are you lonely?
Yeah. And you know,
more information.
Yeah. And so, you know, do you look like some sort of terrorized, stretched out Catwoman, or do you,
yeah.
you know, or do you age?
Personally, I'm attracted to this terrorized, stretched out
do
Catwoman.
Do you?
Hunter Moss, we're at our limit now, and if I don't pee soon, I'm going to die.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But this is the kind of conversation I very much appreciate.
Yeah.
And I love because you are helping us put everything into perspective, which is why this is really the only podcast to listen to. Let's be honest.
Yeah, but the thing I would say, Brian, is that this is not about any one of us, right?
Yeah.
The important thing is that what emerges from between us, and that's really where intelligence emerges from. It doesn't emerge from individuals, right? Which is sort of the old way of thinking, right? And this is part of what Haidt talks a lot about, is that individuals aren't very smart, but collectively, right? The collective effect of science, for example, or the collective effect of this conversation, is that we can create intelligence between us.
Mm.
As we challenge each other's thinking, both of our thinking becomes sharper. And the dream is that by the end of this, we are both, you know, have full mastery of this material and then can turn it into comedy and entertainment.
So it diffuses.
That's right.
And we get it into other people's brains.
That's right.
MMA for the Mind, ladies and gentlemen. Starring Brian Callen and most importantly, the big Dutchman who is a threat, a bigger threat to civilization than Kim Jong-un and Kim Kardashian.
That's true.
Hunter Motz, M-A-T-T-S.
M-A-A-T-S.
I'm sorry, M-A-A-T.
Brian, how long have we known each other?
That's what I meant. That's what I meant.
No, but can we talk about how long we've known each other?
I've certainly known you since you were a baby, probably.
Yeah, the first place that I went after leaving the hospital in Riyadh was to your house.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You were a little
baby.
And you
still don't know how to spell my last name.
I do. M-A-A-T-S. I look at it every day when I call you. Ladies and gentlemen, that's our time. God bless you, and God bless America.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.